Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court.
CAF Chats. I am Major Rianne Wentz, one of the faculty here in the Criminal Law Department, and I am here with three outstanding guests. I'd like to have them go around and introduce themselves, and we'll start with Carter.
Hi, my name is Carter Gamary. I am a 1L student at the University of Virginia Law School right next door.
Thanks.
Hey, and I'm Anthony Freyer. I'm a 2L at UVA Law.
And my name is Amanda. I'm a 3L at UVA Law.
Thank you all so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Today we're going to talk about the CAF case of United States versus Palak, which is fundamentally an IAC case, but we talk a lot about RCM 914. And you all are learning about the rules for courts-martial and CAF as students in Major Barrett's critical analysis of the military justice system. So I'm excited to have you all on today. And first, we're going to have Carter. We're going to talk about the facts of this case.
All right. So the appellant Ryan M. Palak and the victim Airman First Class were stationed together at Royal Air Force Base Mendenhall in the UK, and they began dating in 2019. This case arises out of two incidents, the first occurring in July of 2020, when after returning from a local bar, the two had an argument which escalated in Palak choking the victim. The following month, the second incident occurred where the two returned from the same local bar. Another argument ensued in which Palak found texts on the victim's phone referencing another man, and both parties threw each other's phones out of their apartment window. And the argument culminated in Palak choking the victim again. The victim also testified that during that incident, Palak also hit her with the bedroom door 10 to 15 times. However, at the lower court, Palak was acquitted of those charges, so they are not part of this appeal. Following the second incident, the victim reported the assaults through her chain of command and was interviewed by OSI agents who also took her pictures. The special investigator had testified that these interviews were recorded, but then later lost due to being deleted off the system for an unknown reason before they could be downloaded to a CD, which was customary practice to download those interviews onto CD before deletion. This realization that they had been deleted was not found until 2 months after the interviews were conducted. And during the trial, the special investigator testified that the interviews being recorded and subsequently lost right before the victim was called as the next witness for the government. During this time, the trial defense did not raise an RCM 914 motion seeking the production of the recordings.
Carter, thanks so much. And the really important facts to take from what Carter just talked about was the fact that this is a case where the testimony of the victim is going to be really, really important to the case. And then also the fact that during the investigation, the recordings were made and then lost. They basically weren't pulled from the system, right? And so because they weren't pulled from the system, they were lost and weren't available to be produced under a 914 motion. So Amanda, I want to turn it over to you to talk a little bit about the procedural history of the case.
Right, so at trial, the appellant was convicted of the charged offenses based on the victim's allegations. After the conviction, the appellant appealed the decision to the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals based on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim against his trial defense counsel for failing to file that RCM 914 motion. The Court of Criminal Appeals then ordered trial defense counsel to submit declarations explaining why they did not file that RCM 914 motion, and then found later that the appellant did not overcome the presumption of competence when attempting to show deficient performance by his defense counsel, and so holding that the appellant did not have an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Later, the Court of Appeals then granted review on the issue of whether defense counsel had provided ineffective assistance by failing to file that RCM 914 motion after the victim's testimony. And that's the case that we're on now.
Amanda, thanks so much. The issue that CAF granted on was the following. The government lost the only two video recorded statements from SM, the complaining witness, for every convicted offense. Did defense counsel provide ineffective assistance by failing to file an RCM 914 motion after SM's testimony? Now, Anthony, how did the court answer that question? What was the holding in this case?
Yeah, the court ultimately held that the trial defense counsel provided ineffective assistance by failing to bring a motion under RCM 914. The court argued that there was a reasonable probability that the defense would have prevailed on the merits of an RCM 914 motion, compelling the military judge to either strike the victim's testimony or declare a mistrial. It's probable that either of these remedies would have led to a different result in the trial. The elements of appellant's ineffective assistance of counsel claim being satisfied, the decision of the lower court was reversed and a rehearing was authorized.
Anthony, thanks so much. That's exactly right. Now, as Amanda talked about, the lower courts asked the trial defense counsel to produce affidavits or declarations that talked about why they made the decision that they did. Why did they not file this 914 motion? Because if they had filed this 914 motion, it was very likely that the victim's testimony would have been excluded or a mistrial would have been granted. And the defense counsel's rationale was that they didn't raise the issue because they didn't want the government to put in the extra effort to find the recordings and then to use them as a prior consistent statement. And then defense also wanted to be able to cross-examine the OSI agent on what they were going to argue was a shoddy investigation. And so that was the defense counsel's sort of rationale. And when we're looking at the defense counsel's rationale and we're looking at IAC, we have to look and see, the court's going to look and see, rather, did the defense counsel provide some sort of reasonable explanation for their failure to raise a motion or failure to do something? And when military courts look at IAC, they use the Strickland versus Washington standard, and it is in the form of three parts. And those three parts are the appellant's allegations true? And if so, is there a reasonable explanation for counsel's actions? If the allegations are true, did defense counsel's level of advocacy fall measurably below the performance ordinarily expected of fallible lawyers? And if the defense counsel was ineffective, is there a reasonable probability that, absent the errors, there would have been a different result? So that's ultimately the question that the court is asking here and sort of talks about for several pages during their opinion. And one of the things that I want to point out to the listeners is that we got to remember that IAC is a very deferential standard. Courts are really loath to do what they call Monday morning quarterbacking because they know that there are myriad ways to try a case, especially from the defense side. And courts don't know everything that the defense counsel does. And so it's hard for them to say, you made a tactical error, you made a wrong decision, you were ineffective, unless it's in a really egregious case. And so I think there's language about Monday morning quarterbacking and that the courts really don't want to second guess what defense counsel are doing unless it's in a really obvious case. And the court talks about the standard and sort of how it's evaluated and talks about how strategic choices made by counsel after a thorough investigation of the law and facts are virtually unchallengeable. So that's that deferential standard that I was talking about. However, an attorney's ignorance of a point of law that is fundamental to his case, combined with his failure to perform basic research on that point, is a quintessential example of an unreasonable performance under Strickland. So not only are we dealing with Strickland, but we're also dealing with RCM 914. And RCM 914 tracks the language of the Jenks Act. And basically, RCM 914 says that after a witness testifies, upon motion, that the party that is putting in that evidence has to provide any and all statements by that particular witness. And if they fail to do so, then either the military judge will instruct the fact finder to disregard that testimony or a mistrial can be granted. So the potential remedies are really pretty extreme under 914. But one of the ways that that has been sort of tempered just a little bit, and it's included in the rule of RCM 914, and we also see it in cases like Muwakil and Sigra, is that there's this sort of good faith doctrine, this judicially created good faith doctrine. And essentially what that says is that if the government didn't lose the recording in bad faith, then those extreme remedies aren't going to be applied to that case. Now, the opinion breaks the analysis up into two parts and talks about how there's sort of the analysis during pretrial discovery, and then there's the analysis at trial. And the court gives the defense the benefit of the doubt during pretrial. And they say, okay, that makes some sense for you to not ask and for you to not raise this issue during pretrial discovery, because, you know, maybe they do work harder and go find it, and then, you know, sort of all of these concerns that you have come true. But the problem is that once the victim testifies at trial, the court says it was clear that OSI had indeed lost the recordings. And the court comes down pretty hard and says, if the defense had filed a successful 914 motion, the military judge would have been required to either strike the victim's testimony or declare a mistrial. Thus, at the time of trial, there was tremendous upside and virtually no downside for the defense to file the RCM 914 motion. And then the court also goes on to say that ultimately the two tactics that the defense wanted to use were not necessarily mutually exclusive at trial. And so ultimately, as a result of all of this, the court says that it was ineffective assistance of counsel and ordered the rehearing, just like Anthony said. So now the question is what does the field do with this? What are some lessons that can be learned as a result of this case? And I'll be honest, obviously the biggest takeaway from my perspective is, you know, you gotta file the motion. And if you don't file the motion, you need to have a really, really, really good reason to. And then also the fact that your decision, your tactical decision, might change with the changing landscape of trial, might change with the changing landscape of the case, because facts are changing all of the time. And so file the motion, especially in the context of 914. The remedies are so stark and so beneficial for the defense that, I mean, as a defense counsel, as somebody who's sat in trial, who has gone through these cases, I understand that you kind of think about all of the second, third order effects and what might happen if I file this motion or what happens if I don't. And you think about all of those things. But in the context of 914, if you've got evidence that the recording existed and then was lost by the government, facts like this, then I think you're hard pressed to not file that motion. I think the second takeaway for all counsel, but in particular defense counsel, is, you know, don't lose the forest for the trees. And a little bit that's what it felt like. But again, I know, I absolutely am aware that I am sitting here on a podcast, you know, a year or so later, Monday morning quarterbacking these defense counsel. But it felt a little bit like they were losing the forest for the trees. And it that came across, I think, in the CAF opinion. And then the last thing is to either war game or murder board. And for our guests, a murder board is where you take your case and you present certain issues, or you present your theme and theory, or you present things that you're concerned about, and you present it to other attorneys who can give you good advice. Hey, here's what I thought about your opening. Here's what I think about this legal issue. Oh, have you thought about filing this motion? Because while there can be too many cooks in the kitchen, to extend a metaphor, in many cases, when you're trying cases, two heads are better than one, because you get so lost in the facts. You are so busy, and you are a little bit overwhelmed, and you've got a lot of clients, and you've got you know, your own life, you've got family, you've got other stuff. And so sometimes it can be a little bit hard to sort of make sure that you're seeing the whole picture and not just a small portion of it. So my recommendation is to war game or murder board and really think through these types of tactical decisions. So that's Palak, and I want to move on for just a few minutes because we've got such outstanding guests here. I'd like to go around and just ask you what got you interested in the critical analysis of the military justice class. And so I'll start with Carter. If you would just tell us a little bit about how you heard about it and why you took the class.
Yeah, so I am a prior service Marine infantry. And so during that time in my life, the UCMJ was something that was a big part of my life. So when I learned about this class, it was last semester. There's a vets group at UVA, and they kind of were discussing the classes over here. When I learned about this class, it was something that immediately sparked my interest, and it was something that I knew that it would be fun to take.
Awesome. Anthony?
Yeah, like Carter, I'm prior service, initially Army National Guard, infantry, currently in the Air Force Reserves. I took a course here last year, Rights of the Accused, and frankly, I loved the class. It was nice to actually work with practitioners, people who are actually doing this stuff, as opposed to the more kind of academic setting of, law school. So after that experience, I knew that I'd be taking as many classes as I could here. So naturally, when it was time to pick courses for, this year, I enrolled for critical analysis at the UCMJ.
Amanda?
So for me, I have no prior service. But I did take two JAG courses last spring that I also really enjoyed. It was Law of Sea Airspace Operations and War Crimes and Atrocity Law. Initially, I had taken those classes because there were specific topics within international law that the law school, UVA Law School, didn't offer, and I had no other expectations. But I ended up really enjoying my experience in those classes. I think the different structure, where it was mostly discussion-based, and I got to hear, like Anthony said, about practitioners' opinions over just, reading through a casebook. I really enjoyed that. And I thought it was really interesting to just learn about this completely different legal system that does have, very significant real-life implications and applications. And so this semester, I knew I wanted to take another JAG course, and this one looked the most interesting.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, thank you all for being on Criminal Law Presents. I appreciate it. Amanda, best of luck with the bar.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that anybody who's listening to this who has taken a bar, their stomach just clenched a little bit for you. So it won't be a fun summer, but at the end of it, you will be a licensed attorney, and we will welcome you to the profession. So, for Carter and Anthony, best of luck next year. I hope your outlines are done because it's almost finals time, right?
Yeah, final start next week.
Okay, well then no, we'll wrap it up. Best of luck. Thank you so much. And for those of you who are listening, please like and subscribe. Criminal Law Presents. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The court will stand in recess until further order of the court.